Good evening. Thank you for coming. The five precepts express a set of fundamental spiritual principles, and each precept has a positive and negative form. The positive form expresses what we are aiming for. The negative advises what not to do. The first precept in Pali is Panatipata, Veramani, Sikkhapadam, Samadhiyami. The positive form of the first precept is, in deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. And the negative form is, I undertake the training principle of not harming living beings. In this talk, I shall be focusing on the positive form and principle of the first precept, the development of loving kindness, which is also known as expressed as metta. In the metta bhavana meditation, we wish ourselves and others be well, be happy, and be free from suffering. I cannot tell you how much I struggle with this practice. I often feel like a parrot when I'm doing the first stage of this practice. I struggle with the development of self-metta. But I continue with my practice in the hope that one day I will be able to really feel all the well wishes that I feel for others, for myself. I found my struggle with the first stage even more challenging when I discovered I can develop compassionate feelings in the fourth stage, which is for people who I experience difficulties with. I could identify from one human to another, everyone is really trying their best. And sometimes we make mistakes. However, when it comes to my very own mistake, it all becomes a different matter. I tend to be less forgiving with my own mistakes, and I very often have very harsh words with myself in my inner world. How can I be feeling so much for others, and yet I feel so little for myself? The lack of appreciation I have for myself become more apparent to me when I was doing Karuna appeals, and I have done four. What I found is that I could not bear to hear other people's appreciation of me. For example, when someone tells me how supportive I had been to them, instead of just listening, absorbing and rejoicing to all the positive affirmation and merits people were trying to assert me with, my inner record player plays a slightly different tune. It will either be, you could have done more, or actually it wasn't good enough. When people point out I'm being generous, my inner recorder goes, well, there's nothing generous about what you have just done. Whether it is about being generous with my time or with finance, I often think to myself, it is because I have spare time or cash to spare. Sometimes I do get to a point where I can acknowledge, yes, I'm being generous. My inner recorder will then go, just because you have the ability and chance to share your surplus doesn't particularly make you kind. In this context, I am my very own worst enemy. In spite of my regular witnessing and experiencing of kind deeds done by others, especially in this movement, I was nowhere near to developing metta for myself until earlier this year. On the New Year's retreat at Taraloka, I came to an understanding to the importance of the act of kindness. One afternoon, while lounging around in a lounge, I noticed this woman across me had a towel on her feet, and she kept on leaning up, she wrapped her feet, and then she lies down again. And I saw this like a few times, you know, we were all in silence. So I was thinking to myself, is that actually what this woman needs is a pair of warm socks. A lot of people seem to forget to bring warm socks on retreat for some reason. But we were in silence, so I couldn't actually, you know, ask this lady if that's what she needs. Anyway, I went upstairs, grabbed a pair of my spare socks and gave it to her. In that silent moment, I experienced my gesture brought her joy. I was glad she no longer had to suffer from the cold weather. That split second made me truly understand the importance of kindness. The experience made me think, if only I can just be kind to myself, then perhaps I can learn to be not so critical with myself. I was and still am aware that my lack of self-matter does not only create hardship for myself. It can and has caused suffering to others too. For example, the expression of my frustration with myself can come out in a harsh and aggressive tone when I'm speaking to others. The first precept is a principle that finds expression in all the other's precepts. Anyway, after about a month ago, I discovered I lost a glove. I was brought up in a family where things are always organized. Things that were used were often placed back to where they were designated. Of course, I had my fair share of misplacing things when I was growing up. I'm not sure how many times I was told, if my head was not stuck to my body, I would have lost it too. This training and upbringing of mine made me into a person who would get agitated very easily when I have to spend time looking for things that I have misplaced or lost. So I was not pleased with myself that I've lost my gloves. 2 days later, on my way to Mitra's study, I couldn't find my bag and my house keys. My inner record player kicked straight in. "See how careless you are. You have lost your glove, you lost your bag, and now you have lost your house keys. You will have to call the locksmith to change your lock because you don't even know if you have left your keys in the door. And now you will also have to miss your Mitra study. If your head is not stuck to your own body, you will have lost it too." As soon as I realized my automatic recorder was on, I stopped and sat myself down, as if I was with a child who's slowly turning hysterical. I had to acknowledge to myself all my losses were not intentional. They were mistakes. It was not like I've decided to be callous and start losing things. Straight after the talk I had with myself, I found my keys in my inner jacket pocket. Padmalila found my glove in the shop 5 days later, and I found my bag a week later. Our thoughts are the result of our past action and conditioning. We do not have a choice over which one will pop up in any one time. What we do have is a choice on how we work with it. I believe my practice for metta is finally taking its form and shape in the practice of forgiveness. I know this practice and development will not just benefit me, it will also benefit to all. In conclusion, the precepts are sometimes called training principles, and it is important that we all see it in the spirit. Like playing an instrument, if we expect ourselves to be perfect from the start, we would mentally beat ourselves up whenever we hit a wrong note, and we would soon give up. If we see the precept as practices we train ourselves with, we will gradually get better at it. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to speak about truthful communication. It's not an easy topic to talk about. So in the precepts, there are four precepts which is to do with the speech. And I'm just going to read them out to you one by one. So the fourth precept is the principle of restraint. I've changed the word because I couldn't pronounce it properly. So I chose the word that I can pronounce better. The principle of restraint from forced speech or truthfulness. The fifth precept is the principle of restraint from harsh speech or kindly speech. The next one is the principle of restraint from frivolous speech or meaningful speech. The seventh precept is the principle of restraint from slanderous speech or harmonious speech. So that's the topic. And in the introduction, I thought I'd like to start with one of the way that people sort of start a talk, if you want to call it talk, in our movement, and that is to do with gratitude. So I'd like to start it with gratitude, my gratitude to people who sort of taught me how to meditate, and that had an impact on my life, and they brought me here. Well, the first person is our teacher, Sankarakshita, who started this movement. And then the next person, well, there are two people. One of them is Vadramati, who taught me how to meditate it in 92. And at the time, she wasn't Svadramati, she was a Mitra, and her name was Mary. And the other person is an order member. I don't want to pronounce his name wrongly, but I'm not sure. I'm going to do my best. And again, at the time, he wasn't an order member, he was a Mitra. And his name is Vajrachakshtu. And I'm very grateful to them too, because they used to come to the college and teach us how to meditate many years ago. The third one is my beloved Moksha Bandhu. He used to run the Friday class, and because of him I'm here, otherwise I would have gone. And lastly, not least, my lovely Kalyana Mitrata, Shubha and Vanaraji. I studied about 2.5 years, 3 years Mitra study with these lovely women, and then continue my friendship with them. So I just want to sort of start it off with gratitude. So I'll put that in my introduction. Then the next bit of the talk, if I find my paper, I'm going to find it in a minute. Yeah, that was introduction. I sort of put down the question, why am I here? Like, why am I here practicing Buddhism? And the answer for me is suffering. That is the answer for me. My life has got sort of a big impact and sort of flavor of suffering in it. And it's not a bad thing, because that has pushed me and pushes me to practice on a daily basis. So I'm not a type of person that I'm here because it's good for me to do it in that way, you know, inverted comma. You know, I'm not here because I want to be a good girl. That doesn't work for me. I'm here because life is pushing me to be here. And I'm so grateful for it. That is the way it goes for me. So I put down suffering and I put down sort of growth next to it. Because within suffering, it can be the seed for growth if one wants to pay attention to it. Because we don't necessarily sort of grow just because we suffer. I think we have to sort of pay attention, and we have to be aware enough to grow. And I think I've sort of been lucky that, you know, that I have had that sort of, and I do have that sort of condition around me to sort of pay attention to my conditions and what's going on for me. So the next bit that I want to sort of talk about is, what is truth? I mean, it's good that, you know, if you come and say, oh, it's good to talk about truthful communication, but what is truth in the first place? And I think that's quite challenging, to sort of say, what is truth? Because I think it's easy to sort of come up with sort of few lines and say, oh, this is truth. But whose truth is it? You know, I think there is a definition for it, and whose definition are we going to use? So I sort of searched around, and luckily I found a definition by Sankarakshita in one of his books. So I'm just going to read that. So he says, the truth is that which produces positive results, or which leads one in a positive direction. And I thought, that's fantastic. I didn't want anything sort of glory. You know, that is simple, but at the same time, down to the point. If something takes me to the positive place, then that is the truth. But that's what he says. How do I operate in my daily life? How do I see truth in my daily life? And when I sort of thought about it and sort of reflected on it, I sort of thought about where there is a relativity. There is a point of like, in my daily life, do I say what I benefit from it, or do I say irrespective what is going to benefit me? So in a way, it's very easy to sort of say, oh, this is the truth, just stick to it and continue with it. But at the same time, in the practicality of life, I find it difficult to stick to black and white. I don't think it is black and white. So I think what I've learned from my spiritual life within Buddhism, within our movement, that I keep going back to what is my volition and to why do I do something, even if it's a truthful statement. And if I keep sticking to that, that makes it easier for me to assess it if that's the truth or not. Because I might even come and say a truthful statement, but if I don't come from a place of love, then I don't think that is truthful, irrespective of the facts and the figures. So within that, I put down sort of the personal relationship with why I want to say it or not to say it, and the volition, and also the choice. I think personally, you know, all of us, we do have a choice to sort of say it or not. Most of the time, not all the time, most of the time. And it's up to us to sort of do it or not do it, taking everything into account. Then the next bit, I thought, okay, now that we sort of talked about, okay, what is the truth, and I've sort of brought down my own sort of stuff around it, why do I want to speak the truth? Why should I bother? I mean, in a daily life, in my experience, most of the time it's easier to get on by lying. So why do I bother to sort of go and say the truth? And when I sort of sat down and reflected back on my personal experience, I think that's the time that I sort of thought about more, maybe deeper reason for it. And I sort of remember a few years ago that I was in a relationship, in a happy relationship, but unfortunately something wasn't working. And because something wasn't working, I sort of felt, well, you know, something in me felt I needed to do something differently, which wasn't skillful. And for many years, I was able to stay with that sort of lie or that sort of deceitful action in myself. I was easily, I could live with it, and easily I could continue with it. And then about a few years later, I remember I was doing my Mistral Study project, and I decided to do my Mistral Study project on the Heart Sutra. So here I was sitting at the dinner table in the kitchen and writing my sort of project about the Heart Sutra. And then this thing inside me was nagging me. So there was this bit of me which was nagging me, and there was other bit of me which wanted to continue with the norm as I was operating. So that continued. So it was a battle between two parts of me, if I want to call it. And for a few days, I sort of went on with that and went on with that. And each time I sat down to sort of continue with my project, I found it harder and harder to continue with it. And eventually, I thought, I can't do this anymore. I just couldn't continue with that lie in my head anymore and in me anymore. And I needed to sort of talk to the person about it. So going back, why do I want to speak the truth? I think when we get involved in a spiritual life, when we do practice, it comes a point that somehow we don't have a choice. somehow something in us doesn't want to continue the normality of life anymore. And if the normality of life is lying, and by lying everything is easier, doesn't want that anymore. And I think that is just organic, and that's the reason for me. I don't want to lie, for example. I want to have a sort of truthful communication and speech. But it's a lie in itself if I say that I want to do that all the time, because I'm not doing that all the time. That's my expression, that I want to sort of have a truthful communication with people around me, but I don't do it. So going back again to how can I keep this alive, this sort of the threshold alive that keeps me on the line, I need to sort of practice, and I need to sort of remind myself that I've got the ability, or something in me has got the ability to follow the truth, and then other part of me might not want to follow the truth, but I need to be aware of it to bring them together. And if I'm aware enough, then most of the time I might be able to communicate the truth and say the truth. So so under that section I put this. So for me, the reason wanting to communicate the truth and speak about the truth, I think it goes back to that point of the threshold in one's psyche or one's existence or one's consciousness or one's awareness, whatever we want to call it. But for me is that. So that's that bit. So the next bit, the next section, I'm trying to sort of give it a continuity. Yeah. So why do I want to speak the truth? Why should I bother? So I said that. Then the next bit is how do I cultivate the truthful communication? So if I'm aspiring, if my inspiration is to communicate that, how do I get that far? And what's been coming up for me is awareness. That is something that more and more and more and more sort of plays up for me. And in order to get to awareness for me is doing my practices that I do. And the practices that I do for me, that works for me, is a devotional practices like Sevenfold Puja, like chanting. And I guess for me, I need to find something that really resonates with the way I work. And the way I work is that. And the other thing that really works for me is talking to someone else about it. And what I mean by talking to someone else about it, not necessarily just sort of talking to a friend about, oh yeah, I've done this wrong, but trying to explore it, that if I, for example, if I lied to someone at work, and immediately I felt yucky about it, and immediately I felt, I didn't want to do that, but I still done it, what helps me is to come home and to make an offering. And that offering for me is, if you want to call it confession, I come from a Muslim background, so confession doesn't have a negative connotation for me. But when I was mentioning it to a friend, they said, it might be a negative connotation for people who come from Christianity background. I don't know. But it works for me that I come home and I sort of do my puja to Vajrasattva. And within that context of Vajrasattva puja, I sort of write down what I've done for the day, for example, the lie, and I offer it to him. And by doing that, it's not necessarily that I sort of get rid of the responsibility. I don't think I'm getting rid of the responsibility. I think by doing that, I'm trying to sort of say that I need something bigger. And in order to get something bigger, I need to aspire to something bigger. And for me, Vajrasattva represent that I need something bigger for me to be able to stop doing the action that I don't want to do anymore. And that really works for me. So for me is devotional practices, Sevenfold Puja, confession, and chanting. So within that activity, I sort of experience every moment, well, when I say every moment, within every moment of an example, there is a sense of something new wants to come forth for example, not wanting to lie. But in order for that something new coming forth and get form, something else has to die. So there is that birth and death. And we do talk about a spiritual sort of spiritual, you know, death and rebirth, don't we? I mean, I've heard it, you do talk about it. And I'm just thinking, in day-to-day experience, we can look at it like that. We can look at it even with precept, speechful, truthful communication. We can look at it like that. That in order for me to sort of get to the next bit of speaking truthfully about something very, very difficult, something in me has to change, something in me has to die in order for something new, which there's a possibility of coming forth and get form and become me, to do that. And that happens for me within the concept of confession. And that works for me. So how do I cultivate that? So I'm getting to the next bit, which is to do coming to sort of end of it, sort of getting all this together. So we're starting with the precept. What is the truth? Why do we want the truth? You know, why do we want to do that? How do we go about it? And then where is that going to take us? You know, the whole thing, why do we do all that? And I guess we do that because on some level, we don't have a choice. That's how life is. Life is, and we do have a choice within it. And I think for me, that's where it is. I am here, I am living, and life is bigger than I am. So I'm wanting, I'm here. So I might as well make a positive sort of choice and go along with it and do my best and then see what comes out of it. And I think I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you.
When Vanuraji emailed me and asked me to give a talk on the mindfulness precepts, at the time I felt my life was kind of collapsing. There's a lack of mindfulness and I thought that's going to be completely aspirational. And I think it probably still is, but I think probably something's come out of actually writing it. I do a lot of talks in other situations, so I have an awful habit of having to give everything a title. So I've given this talk a title. And I very cheekily have two quotes. One is a very well-known quote, from the Buddha, no less, "With mindfulness, strive on," apparently his last words. And a less famous quote from me, "Why aren't there any post boxes on Leighton High Road?" It will become clear. Okay, so the precept. Negatively, I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. So obviously that's about a kind of guarding against a loss of awareness. Normally read as abstaining from alcohol or drugs, although can obviously be many other things, and I shall come to that shortly. And in its positive formulation, "With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind." And obviously that's referring to the kind of cultivation of mindfulness and the kind of impact of that, or what it can have on our lives. But to me that feels kind of, when I first came across it as probably somebody who was completely lacking mindfulness at the time, it's like, what on earth does that mean? And I kind of remember looking at this in Mitra's study and looking at the kind of traditional threefold meaning of mindfulness, which I found very useful, and I'm just going to kind of remind us of that. So that first thing is around simply that state of being present. So being present in my actual experience. So the fact that I feel slightly nervous now, I feel like my legs are a little bit jiggly. Secondly, that kind of clear knowing. So clearly knowing my purpose and how what I'm doing relates to that goal. And Bhante talks about a mindfulness of purpose. And I think I find that very useful. And thirdly, that awareness of an active ethical sense. So in some ways, the kind of form of being vigilant, a vigilant awareness in which I'm trying to guard against my unskillful actions of body, speech and mind. And those kind of definitions, that kind of understanding of mindfulness, kind of really tries to I really try to underpin that, my practice of mindfulness, whether it's on or off the cushion, and sometimes more off the cushion than on. And we know, I think Vanaraji reminded us a couple of weeks ago, that the Buddha was said to be practicing mindfulness when he gained enlightenment, and that quote a moment ago, with mindfulness strive on, kind of really stresses the kind of absolute importance of it. However, I'm part of preparation for this now. I'm on the team at the moment for the Living Life with Full Attention course, based on the book that Matcha Bandu has written. And he talks about in there that in some ways, mindfulness, if you're aware of it, is actually kind of quite easy to do. But it's actually the remembering to be mindful that is actually really difficult. It's the mindfulness of the mindfulness that is a really difficult thing. And I can certainly know that from my own experience. And I'm going to give you four kind of examples here of my mindfulness, or sometimes my lack of it, as a demonstration. First one is last summer. I was around kind of Covent Garden area, and I was walking up St. Martin's Lane on a very busy Saturday afternoon. And ironically, I was actually going to support one of the classes there, which I think might have been on mindfulness. And I was walking along, and I was texting away on my phone, and I was checking my phone, and I was really agitated because I was waiting for something to come through, and I fell over. So I think I kind of probably learned something there about multitasking isn't always a very useful kind of way to proceed, and it's something that I do a lot. The second one relates to the post boxes in Leighton High Road. Now, I moved to Leighton about a year ago, and every morning I have a 10-minute walk, and most mornings I have a 10-minute walk up to the station. And for a whole year, I have been convinced that there aren't any post boxes on Leighton High Road. And this fits in with the whole bigger narrative I have about living in Leighton, and it's quite a poor area, nobody cares about it, and look, there aren't even post boxes. And it also fits into a habit I have, because I'm really, really bad at posting letters. I can have letters on my side for months and not post them until it's literally too late. So I've had this whole little story going on in my kind of world for a year about Leighton and no post boxes. A couple of weeks ago, I very deliberately took a mindful walk as part of this course up Leighton High Road, the road that I've walked up for a year, and there were three post boxes. And they were almost like I could have walked into those post boxes. They were there, big, bright red post box. So, yeah, awareness and non-awareness. The third one was on a retreat. I've only been coming here 3 years, and this was quite early on retreat I went on. And I was kind of noticing at the time, every time I went on retreat, that I kind of started feeling like I was an outsider, that nobody liked me. And it was particularly when I was on women's retreats, and this was one. And I'd kind of gotten to this big story by about the third day that everybody hated me. Everybody hated me there. And I couldn't possibly see it as a story at the time. It was very real. And I'd gone off for a walk, Vajrasana, and it was a beautiful day, and I was walking really furiously along, and I really wasn't being mindful at all about where I was going. And I suddenly realised that I had kind of taken the wrong direction, because I wasn't paying any attention. And I came up against this cornfield, and it just went like that to me. And I remember just glancing up as I realised the path had come to an end, and I saw the blue sky, the woods, the cornfield. And in that moment, everything just dropped away. And it was absolutely amazing. I felt like I wanted to throw myself into this field. It was just kind of, and I saw so clearly, it was all a story. It was all in my head that I was kind of inventing this story again and again. And I'd been doing it all my life. And I just kind of felt it drop away. So it was this kind of moment of kind of pure mindfulness. It was just incredible. Final example. I went on a solo retreat last year, and I'd been meditating very deeply before I went and while I was there. And suddenly all this fear started to come up, and I'm not somebody that generally feels fear. And the conditions, maybe, I don't know, but I actually just kind of felt, okay, I can sit with this. I can just sit with this experience of this absolute fear. I don't even know what it's about. And on the third day, I actually, after meditating, I came out, I sat out in the garden, it was a beautiful sunny day, and I looked around and I made a very kind of life-changing decision. And at that moment, the fear just went, and I knew that that was the right decision. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. That's the cliffhanger. I'm going to keep you wondering about that for a moment. But what I want to do, for step back just a little bit, and actually talk about me and my biography. And you've got to listen. And it's a relationship to this. I teach. Students don't normally listen to me. This is kind of amazing. And talk about its relationship to that precept of mindfulness. And I'm not going to bore you with all the details. You don't need to worry. But I know that as a child, I developed a lot of strategies to distract me. I kind of could endlessly daydream for hours. I lived in a whole little fantasy world. I was very unaware of my surroundings, hence not noticing the postboxes and things like that still. And I think I'm not unique in that. I think lots of children do that for lots of different reasons. And I think at the time that was probably very necessary. And I think I honour that skillfulness I had as a child to actually do that, to take myself out of a situation. However, obviously I learnt from a young age to ignore my feelings, to ignore my primary experience, not to kind of look at my feelings, and instead to kind of just jump to reaction. So to not be mindful at all, to just react to things. Sometimes skillfully, but more often in very unskillful ways. And of course I carried that on into adulthood. There's no reason why I shouldn't have. And obviously as an adult I was able to develop lots more ways to distract myself from me, from being with who I was. And many of them were deeply intoxicating, I think, in many senses of the word. So in my 20s I smoked a lot of dope, I drank a fair amount of alcohol. In my 30s I gave up the dope smoking, I moderated the alcohol. But I managed to secure a very well-paid job, and that led to a different kind of intoxication for me, of spending. I suddenly could go out and I could spend money on whatever I wanted. And it resulted in a huge pile of debt that I've eventually had to deal with. But it was a form of intoxication, there was no doubt about it. And along the way I've used people, real people there, people I was having friends or relationships with, or I fantasized about, I had this whole kind of dream world of people, has a pure distraction as a form of intoxication from being with myself and my lived everyday experience. Now, I'm not going to pretend for one moment that all this was doom and gloom. It certainly wasn't. And after all, part of why things are so intoxicating, I think, is because we get something from them, even if that something is ultimately kind of really not very healthy for us or isn't bringing us happiness. And I kind of know at the time that whatever I got from those experiences, it was always tinged with a lack of satisfaction. I guess I'd call it dukkha now, didn't know the word at the time. But there was always this little glimmer of awareness at the back of my mind that none of it was really helping me or getting me to where I wanted to be. But the trouble was, I didn't have a clue where I wanted to be. I didn't have that sense of purpose, that mindfulness of purpose, because I didn't know what I really, really wanted. And that really kind of brings me up to kind of my present circumstances. So I've been meditating, practicing Buddhism for a little over 3 years now. And in that time, I've really kind of learnt, and I'm learning daily, to become much more aware of my experiences, my feelings, what they actually are, my behaviours, my reactions when I do just simply go into react. I'm so much more aware of it. Not saying I don't do it, but I'm aware of it. And also to kind of question my motivations. Why am I behaving in this way? And I think But as with any of us, when we become more aware, we start to have a choice. There becomes a choice about what we want to do. And I don't always make the skillful choice, even when I know I have a choice. I sometimes still go down the unskillful route, the wrong road. But more and more I'm able to kind of ask myself, what is motivating me in any particular situation? Am I being motivated by greed, by hatred, by delusion, by my kind of egoistic desires for something? Or is it something of a higher value? Does it involve compassion? Does it involve love? Does it involve some kind of understanding of, or movement towards understanding the kind of true nature of reality? And I think by becoming more mindful about my motivations, it's actually helping me, very, very slowly, to become more mindful of what might be motivating other people, or to ask that question. So instead of simply reacting to other people, but to actually step back and think, okay, what's motivating this person to behave in this way? Why? And I hope that I can kind of start towards to develop more compassion and understanding towards them. And I think it's this issue of mindfulness of purpose, that second kind of thing around mindfulness that I read early on, that feels very central in my life at the moment. Because I said earlier, for most of my life it has simply lacked it. I've kind of felt that I've kind of gone along with things. Things have opened up to me, sometimes opportunities, I've taken them, but there's never been a kind of, right, I'm going to do this, this is what I'm getting on and doing. And I think indeed when I stumbled across meditation, stumbled across Buddhism, it was the same. I don't think I really knew why I was attracted to it. I'd absolutely no idea. But at the same time, there was something at almost an instinctual level, and that's not a word that sociologists say much, but at an instinctual level told me that I had found something that would quite literally change my life for the better. And it has done so. I know it in so many ways. And I found it really difficult to put into words, because I was thinking, I almost feel like in having found this purpose, that it's, sometimes I feel it drives me even when I'm not working on it. It's very hard to explain. Sometimes it's almost like my own desires, my own wants are almost like completely different from what I then turn around and do, because I know that that's going in the right path. So for example, very shortly after getting involved with the centre here, I moved from Guildford, where I work, to live in a women's community in London, where I don't work. Made my life a lot more difficult in some ways, but in other ways I knew that I had to do that. I became a mitra very shortly afterwards. I subsequently asked for ordination, and that's from somebody who'd rejected all forms of religion, all forms of organised religion at a very young age. I gave up spending my spare time in less than skillful ways, which i.e. going round shops spending money, and started spending much more of my time here at the centre. I actually sometimes feel I live here, but and right at the moment I'm in the process of helping start a new women's community, even though having lived on my own for a year, I love it. I love living on my own. I love my nice little selfish ways and my place and where everything is, and I know it. But at the same time, I know that I need that. I know that I need to kind of move forward and live in a women's community, because that's going to be so good for my practice. And back to that solo retreat, I made last year, the life-changing decision I made was that I was going to give up my job, or I was going to work towards giving up my incredibly well-paid, very secure, high-status job, because I just saw that it wasn't making me happy and that it was in many respects a very false refuge, that I was hiding in that, and that it was stopping me from moving forward. It was stopping me from achieving my goal in life, my purpose in life, to kind of live my life in a much more fully humane way, where compassion, love, actually is my guiding principles, my guiding motivations, instead of kind of greed and hatred and so forth. And again, kind of Matthew Bandu talks about in his book about becoming kinder and wiser and more aware is the goal of life with full attention. And I think that that's so important. And it's that I'm trying, sometimes successfully, other times not, to kind of keep in mind when I feel the really seductive lure of the kind of distractions and the intoxications that I could just get myself kind of lost in. And I'm going to finish with a very short poem, which I kind of think is very apt today, about the human body at peace with itself, because I think it's actually summing up, I'm sure many of you know it, I think it really sums up what I'm trying to say. If I can see it against the light. The human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body, it is yours this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty, it is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as a tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal, make use of every day and night to achieve it. Thank you.